This is Paul Hurt and Jen Sweeney of Arizona State University speaking with Kurt Dongoski in Winslow, Arizona on August 15th of 2018. Thanks for sitting with us today, Kurt. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Can you start by telling us your name and the positions that you've held in the Adaptive Management Program over the years and the years in which you've been involved?
Okay, my name is Kurt Dongoski. My initial involvement with the Glen Canyon Dam Adaptive Management Program began in 1991, where I started work at the Hopi Tribe as a tribal archaeologist. In that capacity, I was the representative for the Hopi Tribe as a cooperating agency to the group that was developing the Glen Canyon Dam EIS, Environmental Impact Statement, of which the Adaptive Management Program became part of the final Environmental Impact Statement and the recommendations that came out of the ROD, which then developed the Glen Canyon Dam Adaptive Management Program.
ROD being Record of Decision.
Right, mm-hmm. Sorry. So when I use acronyms, I'll try to remember not to. Then in 90, I also represented the Hopi Tribe in the transition from the cooperating agencies into the Adaptive Management Program from 96 to 97. And I was the alternate AMWIG representative for the Hopi Tribe and the TWIG representative for the Hopi Tribe, the technical work group.
Did you work with Lee Kwanwisima?
Yes.
At that time?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, Lee Kwanwisima was the individual who hired me in 91. And I worked with him closely until 2003 when I left. So I held those positions in the Adaptive Management Program representing the Hopi Tribe until 2003. And also around 2001 or two to, I think it was like 2002 to about 2005, I was the chair of the technical work group. And then I may have these dates wrong, I have to check them. And then there was a 2-year hiatus, and then I was the TWIG chair again for another 2 years, I think. So in total, I've been the TWIG chair for 5 years. And then between when I left Hopi in 2003, I became a consultant to the Colorado River Energy Distributors Association, cultural resource consultant. And I was also their alternate TWIG representative from 2003 to 2000, and I think it was 7 or 8. In 2008, I then became the technical work group representative for the Pueblo Zuni. While I was the consultant for CRETA, I also was hired as a project director for Zuni Cultural Resource Enterprise and worked there doing contract archaeology. And then in 2008, I left ZCRE from 2006 to 2008 and worked for URS Corporation in Phoenix.
What do they do?
URS Corporation is a international engineering environmental compliance sort of corporation.
So you do archaeological clearances for them and
surveys. They're consultants to federal agencies that need archaeological expertise and stuff. And so I found, I found the work with URS nowhere near as rewarding for me personally as working with tribal people. So I went back to Zuni in 2008 and became the principal investigator and director of the Zuni Cultural Resource Enterprise, and at the same time became the Zuni Tribal Historic Preservation Officer and the TWIG representative for Zuni.
And you still hold that position today?
Yes, I still hold that position today, right.
So we have in consultation with Larry Stevens in particular, sort of divided up the kinds of work and efforts being done by people involved in the adaptive management program into primarily scientific research, or primarily policy and management, or primarily social and institutional engagement. And I'm wondering, where do you place your work? Is it sort of a little bit in all three, or are you mainly in one of those three categories of participation?
I think my work covers all three.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of science and research, I'm the one who generates the reports on Zuni monitoring of the river.
Uh-huh.
And taking their observations and concerns and perspectives and putting it into a document that then is communicated to federal representatives.
Uh-huh.
So that they try to put it in language that they'll understand and appreciate.
That can then influence policy and management.
Yes, yeah. And then I also, in terms of policy and management, provide review of documents generated by the center, Grand Canyon Monitoring Research Center,
uh-huh.
or the Bureau of Reclamation. And what the other one was public education?
Social and institutional engagement. Like, for example, Mary Orton was one of our interviewees, and her primary responsibility was to nurture the collaborative process itself to make the adaptive management program, you know, work in a way that's sometimes difficult when you have so many diverse interests at a table.
Right. And so in that realm, my efforts go towards raising the consciousness of the other non-tribal stakeholders to the perspective of Zuni,
uh-huh.
but also the responsibility the federal government, the unique responsibility the federal government has to Native people.
Uh-huh. Can you elaborate on that a little bit, that unique responsibility?
Well, right. I mean, the federal government has a trust responsibility to Native American tribes. And it's a long history of the interaction between tribes and the federal government. Initially, the federal government looked at tribes as sovereign nations that they had to negotiate with, like they negotiated with European powers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was based on, I believe, Spanish, the way the Spanish were originally dealing with the native inhabitants of North America, mm-hmm. South America. But that became cumbersome for them in terms of westward expansion and manifest destiny. So the relationship changed based on some of the, in the early 1800s, by Chief Justice Marshall, who his Marshall Trilogy is pretty famous. But in that, identified that there was a trust relationship between the federal government and tribes. Mm-hmm. Most federal agencies interpret the trust relationship as having to deal with trust assets or things that you can put a monetary valuation on. Whereas I believe that it goes deeper than that. It goes to preserving traditional cultural identity, traditional cultural practices, and the ability of Native people to relate to their cultural landscape that has been influenced by unilateral political decisions without consultation with the tribe by states and federal entities.
And private developers too?
If a private developer is getting some sort of permit, license, mm-hmm. or involvement from a federal agency, then it's the federal agency's responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real relationship in terms of a trust relationship between a private corporation that's developed something and a tribal group. It's strictly between the federal government and the tribe.
So this is probably a good time to ask this question. I'm wondering if you think that tribes are different than other quote-unquote stakeholders in the adaptive management process. And, you know, when choosing who's going to be represented at the table in this collaborative decision-making process, we hear the term stakeholders, and there's recreational fisheries are at the table, and there's the states are at the table, and there's a sort of a series of interest groups that have stakes in the process, and tribes are one of them. They've been recognized as, you know, important stakeholders. But some people argue that they're different than the other kinds of stakeholders. What's your perspective on that?
They are. I think they are completely different from other stakeholders. Oftentimes they're not treated that way. But I think that the tribes have a deep time connection to the Grand Canyon and Colorado River. And it was, and before the United States government decided that they were going to make the Grand Canyon a national park, the tribes had free access and use of that area for the most part. And that, and for Zuni, the Grand Canyon, the Colorado River, has been significant, extremely significant, to their cultural identity since their emergence into this world. And so it goes back to such a deep time that it's not calculable. And so the federal government comes in and displaces and dispossesses Native people of this place that's very important to them, says you can't come in here anymore because we've determined that it's important. And so there is a history of trauma that the tribes have experienced because of that, and now they're under federal regulations on how they access and use that place. So I think that the federal government has responsibility to recognize, acknowledge, and appreciate the fact that they've done harm to these Native groups by restricting them from a very important place, and that they have a trust responsibility to ensure that the tribes have access and use of that place as they should have all along, but were restricted from having. And that at these meetings, they also have to recognize that when the tribes come to these meetings, there is a history of trauma that is the backdrop of their interaction with the federal government, and how that stakeholder table, just the way it operates, there is a power dynamic that the tribes are very sensitive to, where the federal government holds all the cards in terms of power, and that oftentimes the just the interaction at a at the AMWIG or the TWIG table, one has to be very assertive, and that oftentimes is contrary to the cultural
inclinations.
Yeah, the way tribal people treat other people in terms of respect, that you don't confront. You don't argue, you know, you don't become real aggressive and assertive. It's contrary to their cultural beliefs, their cultural norms of how to behave like a respectful Zuni, for instance, because there are so many trout. And that the thing to do is to reduce the numbers of rainbow trout.
And rainbow trout are not native fish to that river system. They were introduced for game.
They were
fishing.
Yes, they were introduced, as I understand it, in the early '60s after the closure of Glen Canyon Dam. But brown trout was introduced into the system back more like in the early part of the last century, 1920s, maybe even earlier.
And they're a European trout, is that right, or just
brown trout? I think it is. But so,
and they eat humpback chub.
They eat anything. From what I understand, I mean, brown trout are very voracious.
Like bullfrogs.
they'll eat anything. I mean, well, humpback chub eat humpback chub. You know, I think that if it's small enough and it's alive and swimming in front of you, you go for it. So they, when I was working at Hopi then, they came out and and talk to Hopi about it. What they plan to do is do electrofishing, mm-hmm. stun the fish. When the fish come up, then they collect all the non-natives, particularly the rainbow trout, and then kill them and turn them into fish emulsion. And that was offensive to Hopi. Mm-hmm. You know, it was offensive because they were going to do it at the confluence of the Little Colorado River and the Colorado River. And
that's a sacred site for the Hopi, right?
Well, for most of the tribes. For uh-huh. Zuni, it is as well. Uh-huh. And part of it is because, well, the confluence represents a place of life, of the joining of two rivers. And there's a lot of life, there's spawning and stuff going on there. And that, as Konawisiuma stated, it would bring an aura of death over a sacred place. Mm-hmm. And so, federal agency said, okay, we won't do it in front of the confluence. We'll do it a mile upstream or a mile downstream from the confluence. But when they actually did it, they did it right in front of the confluence. They ignored. They claimed that it was a miscommunication between the federal agency and their contractor. But I doubt it. I don't believe it. Anyways, so when I was at Zuni in 2008, a Zuni religious leader came in and asked me, are they still killing fish in the Grand Canyon? I said, yeah. He said, that's not right. They should stop that. And I said, well, why? And he explained to me, well, he explained to me this story, that when the Zunis emerged at Ribbon Falls in the Grand Canyon and began their journeys, as the Zuni people were crossing a river. Some say it's the Colorado River, some say it's the Little Colorado River. It's, the exact location is really not important. But as they were crossing, they were told to hold their children on their backs tightly as they crossed the river. As they began to cross the rivers, the children started to scratch them. And so they let the children go, and the children fell into the river and turned into aquatic beings. Turned into fish, turned into water snakes, turned into frogs, turned into tadpoles, and things like that. And so everybody was upset by that. And so the remaining people crossed, they held tighter onto their children. And when they got to another part of the river, they heard the singing and stuff and realized that their children were now aquatic beings. And so this is a really brief rendition of the mm-hmm. story, but that event, that all aquatic beings are Zuni children, are viewed as Zuni children, mm-hmm. whether they're native or non-native, it doesn't matter. And so, from a Zuni perspective, you are killing these fish, you are killing Zuni children. You are killing beings that Zuni has a special relationship to. And they find that offensive. Mm-hmm. Because, as one Zuni religious leader stated, that because Zuni is along the Zuni River. The village of Zuni is, the Zuni River runs right through the village of Zuni. And the Zuni River,
that's in New Mexico.
In New Mexico. It confluences with the Little Colorado River. Oh. And the Little Colorado River confluences with the Colorado River in Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. Thus creating a spiritual umbilical connection to Zuni. So every morning and every night, Zunis go down to the Zuni River, even though it's a dry river now, because they dammed it up at Rama. Uh-huh. They put offerings into the riverbed and send their prayers to the Grand Canyon. And so, killing fish at the confluence with the only motivation is that those fish are not wanted. is an abhorrent idea to Zuni. And they now see the cause and effect of that, of killing those fish, that people in Zuni are dying early. Hmm. That there is a direct cause-effect relationship. That people in Zuni are dying of cancer and other reasons, and they attribute that to during that time. They also attributed to the fact that during the time they were doing the electrofishing, that the Zuni policemen were experiencing the Zuni policemen using an increased use of the tasers on Zuni people. So they saw that as a connection, mm-hmm. a cause and effect relationship.
Something's out of balance in nature, and it has impacts on our culture.
Just like the interviews I was doing the last couple of days, that once you start messing with the balance between the material world and the spiritual world, you're looking for trouble. Mm-hmm. And it's going to come. You don't know where, you don't know when, but it will show up. And so, based on that information, I started in 2008 raising the objection at Twig meetings, saying, you know, look, the Zunis have this concern. You can't be planning war mechanical removal until you start hearing what the Zunis have to say. I was ignored. Completely ignored for over a year. So it finally got their attention, Bureau of Reclamation and GCMRC and the National Park Service and Fish and Wildlife Service, is that the governor of Zuni sent a letter to Bureau of Reclamation saying, your mechanical removal is an adverse effect to a traditional cultural property, which is the Grand Canyon and the Colorado River, or Zuni. And it's caused, and you have to address the adverse effect. You have to mitigate that adverse effect. And you haven't done it, and you haven't consulted. And then all of a sudden, everybody's hair was on fire. And
did it lead to change?
It did. It did, but it took a lot of teeth gnashing and beating your head against a wall. Because as part of this whole dialogue between Zuni and Bureau of Reclamation, and then it got to the Assistant Secretary's office. So Ann Castle came out to Zuni to talk about that to the Zuni people, the Zuni Tribal Council, and the religious leaders. We had a tribal resolution in 2010 that was geared towards the mechanical removal and told the Bureau of Reclamation exactly what Zuni wanted. Because they had, we criticized their science. Mm-hmm. Their science was circumstantial.
That rainbow and brown trout were killing too many humpback chub.
And were affecting the humpback chub population viability. Uh-huh. We were saying, well, what portion of any spawning population would just normally die because they couldn't make it to reproductive age? From either disease or predation or who knows what. Tell us what those percentages are and tell us what effect the predation and competition is having on them. And they couldn't. I said,
they
essentially,
didn't
have enough
research yet to determine that.
We were essentially saying, show us a smoking gun.
Right.
And they didn't have one. We kept hammering this at them. And we kept saying, well, they showed this one article where they developed a model based on the stomach contents of the trout that they killed. They killed like something like 20,000 trout.
Wow.
And, you know, they took the stomach contents out and analyzed them. Well, there was a very, it was less than 1% that they could actually identify as humpback chub. The rest were assumed to be humpback chub, or ones that they couldn't identify. And so based on that, they made a model that said, what was it, that one humpback chub would be eaten by one rainbow trout every day, or something to that effect. I'd have to go back and read it.
Uh-huh.
But the model was not a well-substantiated model, nor was it proven through good ground truthing.
Uh-huh.
And so their predictions of the impact of rainbow trout on humpback chub populations, I think, were erroneous, uh-huh, a bit best.
And that was 2010, you were saying, or later?
Around 2009-10, because they, at that time, they were proposing to add mechanical removal in out-year scopes of work for the center.
Uh-huh. So you pointed out earlier that they originally thought the water was too cold, and that was why the humpback chubs were suffering, and then they decided that it was predation from rainbow and brown trout, but they didn't have great data for either of those hypotheses.
Right.
What do they think it is now, and is this an example of adaptive management in practice? You come up with a hypothesis, you try something, you monitor, you reevaluate, you tweak, and you try again. Is that kind of what adaptive management is all about, and where are we now with our understanding of why the humpback chub is not doing well?
Well, the humpback chub actually is doing well.
Yes, right, recently?
And in fact, several years ago, the humpback chub populations were going up, so were the rainbow trout populations.
At the same time.
And so you go, well, how can that be,
uh-huh,
right?
Uh-huh.
I think, is this a good example of adaptive management? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to think about that for quite a while before I really would render an opinion on that. I think initially reclamation went for the trout as the culprit because it took the focus off the dam.
Right.
Yes.
Because they're in charge of the water and the spill. So if it's cold water is the problem, the Bureau of Reclamation
takes the responsibility.
As responsible.
Right?
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And so you say, wow. It's not the dam anymore, it's those pesky trout, right?
Okay.
But here's the thing, too, that Zuni said, look, you didn't consult with us about building the dam. You didn't consult with us about stocking brown trout. You didn't consult with us about stocking rainbow trout. You did these three things without considering our perspective. And now, because you've done that, your management paradigm has changed from privileging sport fish, because they tried to kill the native fish in the system before, to get rid of the humpback chub and the speckled dace and that sort of thing, so they could promote sport fish.
Mm-hmm.
But your management paradigm has changed, and now you favor biological diversity, particularly native biological diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to get rid of the non-natives. Yet the non-natives have been there for almost 100 years. So we don't view them as natives or as non-natives anymore. But yet your management actions are having a direct effect on us in a negative way. And the federal government didn't accept the Zuni position right away.
Mm-hmm.
They thought I was putting the Zunis up to it. I mean, really.
Yeah.
I was just like, are you kidding me?
Shoot the messenger.
Yeah, exactly. And Cushing documented that story I told you,
uh-huh,
back in the 1880s. Mm. So it's not like something the Zunis just whipped up as a way to irritate the federal government or something that I just came up with. I mean, it's documented. It's been documented for a long time. And so it's a consistent values that Zunis have, mm-hmm, in their relationship to that place. But it was really hard to get the federal government, Bureau of Reclamation, and others to accept that,
mm-hmm,
and to acknowledge and treat in a respectful manner the Zuni position.
So you bring up a couple of thorny issues in adaptive management. One is the difference between being listened to and being influential. And you mentioned that it took a long time to get the federal agencies involved in the adaptive management program to respectfully listen to and accept the perspectives of the Hopi and the Zuni, for example, you work for. But then the question remains, did they change management strategies or policies as a result of finally listening to and respecting those perspectives?
To a degree. So now they have more severe triggers. Before they implement mechanical removal. So the humpback chub numbers really need to start declining, and the rainbow trout numbers need to really start coming up before they decide to implement mechanical removal. Mm-hmm. So that's a positive.
Good.
Okay. But they've also...
Do you remember when that was that they made that?
I think it's... It began in the... in a non-native management plan that was developed by Reclamation back around 2011-12.
Okay.
But then it was implemented in the LTEMP, the Long-Term Experiment Management Plan, EIS.
Okay.
So it's part of that now.
Great.
But they've also included trout management flows, right? Which if they, when the trout spawn, they lower the water from the dam so that they strand the eggs.
And they dry
and
out.
And they desiccate, right. To Zuni, you're just killing them at a different stage of life.
Right.
For no reason, just because you don't want them there.
Yeah.
You know, so they object to that too.
Uh-huh.
So at meetings, I've said, you know, you've heard from Zunis that mechanical removal and trout suppression flows is still negatively affecting Zunis. In fact, they believe Zuni lives are being taken. You still maintain those as viable management actions that are in your toolkit to do the mechanical removal work. I asked the federal government, what's the message you're sending Zuni? That humpback chub lives are more important than Zuni lives? And I get no answer. They don't know how to answer that.
Right.
But isn't that the message they're sending them? From my perspective, it is.
Well, that's the second thorny issue in adaptive management and all other kinds of natural resource management decision making in complex environments with a complex social stakeholders. What do you think is the appropriate way to move forward when, for example, a traditional cultural property and what those who care about that traditional cultural property want done with it conflicts with, for example, the Endangered Species Act. So, you know, early on, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is required to not increase the jeopardy on any endangered species, and their best available evidence, as weak as it was at the time, suggested that predation was a problem, and so they interpreted their legal responsibility as we've got to reduce predation. When the Zuni said, we don't like that particular strategy because it's harming us significantly, what would you say is the appropriate way to move forward in a situation like that?
In terms of that, I'm not convinced that there was rigorous and compelling science.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not convinced that the scientists or the managers at first seriously took the Zuni values as being valid,
mm-hmm.
credible, and something that they wanted to deal with. I think they saw Zuni and its position as being a thorn in their side, and they just wanted to be done with it and get rid of it. I mean, I mentioned the resolution passed by the Tribal Council on this
mm-hmm.
issue.
Mm-hmm.
With that resolution was appended a statement on the issue by the Zuni religious leaders. It was signed by over 30-some Zuni religious leaders.
Mm.
You know how unique that is from Zuni to get something like that document?
Very unusual.
Very unusual. And the Zuni governor handed it to the Assistant Secretary for Water and Science.
Ann Castle at the time?
She just took it and handed it to the director of the Bureau of Reclamation. Didn't even look at it. I found that incredibly insulting in front of the Zunis.
Later she came back and spoke with them, or no?
Well, like I said, the rhetoric's there. Uh-huh. Right, all the right rhetoric is there in terms of talking about Zuni values and how the government's real sympathetic to it. But just that mechanical action, at least to me, signaled that she really didn't care. Uh-huh. This was really something she wasn't that concerned about. And I think it was demonstrated throughout her whole tenure as the designee. Uh-huh.
So you're suggesting that tribes and tribal representatives were not granted equal weight at the table and in negotiations. They weren't granted full respect as stakeholders, at the beginning at least. I've heard you suggest that things changed over time, that there were some improvements. Looking at from the early 1990s to the present, do you think there has been progress made in at least granting a fuller, you know, respect and status for tribal representatives on the Adaptive Management Program teams?
I think that... Well, if you go to the AMWIG or the TWIG and they do a vote, so the tribe has the same sort of voting power as any other stakeholder. But I think if you talk about the issues that are raised by the tribe in a setting like that, that there is more deference given to
Western science.
Western science, but also the position of the basin state representatives.
Okay.
Over the tribes.
So there's a kind of a hierarchy. The federal agencies are really the power center.
Yes.
The state representatives in the Colorado River Basin maybe right behind them in terms of being influential. And then the rest of the stakeholders, including the tribes, kind of underneath that, is that the schema you're suggesting in terms of the power differentials?
Yeah, that's what I was, yeah.
And that's been consistent over the 3 decades, no significant change in shifts in those power positions,
right,
in your
right,
mind? Okay.
Right. I mean, there has been a recognition of the need to have the tribes at the table mm-hmm. because they do fund the tribes at a base amount.
Do they do that for other participants in the program? Other than the federal agencies,
well, they,
which certainly
they
have their own funding, too.
I think they reimburse state representatives and some other folks mm-hmm. for their travel and expenses uh-huh. To going to AMWIG meetings or TWIG meetings. Uh-huh. There's a certain amount of budget that Reclamation has for the other stakeholders. They actually give the tribes money annually for participation. Although that amount of money hasn't changed since it was identified in 1999. So it hasn't fluctuated, you know. And so they continue to ask the tribes to do more with less. Mm-hmm. Much more with much less.
Yeah.
And so the same thing with the funding Zuni monitoring in river trips, which I'm in the process of trying to arrange one, that money hasn't changed either. The amount for that hasn't changed either. So while it's appreciated, mm-hmm. at least from Zuni, that this funding is there that helps to support Zuni's participation and presence at those meetings, it's certainly inadequate funding.
Uh-huh.
To probably participate at a level that Zuni would like to participate.
Well, let's shift gears just a little bit, and I'd like to ask you what significant changes in the program you've seen over time in the broader adaptive management program itself. Are there any stages through which it's evolved in your mind since the 1990s?
I think that GCMRC, as the Grand Canyon Monitoring Research Center, in some respects has become a monster that's out of control.
In what sense?
In developing the science and the research and monitoring programs.
Do you mean that they have too much control over what gets funded for scientific study or something else?
To a large extent there's that. But I think they're they become a bureaucratic Frankenstein.
Can you explain what you mean by that a little bit more? I'm not sure everybody will understand that.
If you read the EIS in 1995, It said that the Grand Canyon Monitoring Research Center was going to essentially have a core of, I think, four or five people. Mm-hmm. One would be the chief. Then there would be a physical resource program manager, a biological resource program manager, a cultural resource program manager, and then administrative assistant helper sort of person. Mm-hmm. And all the science and monitoring research was to be contracted out competitively. But now the USGS has created this monster with all these people in it.
So the U.S. Geological Survey took over the Grand Canyon Monitoring and Research Center a few years after it was created.
It was either supposed to go to, it was going to either be housed in Reclamation or in the USGS. And I can't remember who was walking out the door during the Clinton administration that signed it into USGS.
Yeah.
And at the time, it seemed like a fairly good idea because people's, at least my, I can only speak for me, I guess. Trust in Reclamation was low, that they would do the right thing. And so the USGS is, and maybe it's because I deal with consultation with federal agencies so much on behalf of Zuni, that they are callous to criticism.
USGS?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And just
they don't like to hear it, you mean?
They don't like to hear it, no. No, and they also don't think they have, there's a whole lot of things but that I have against the USGS but in terms of that. But I think that the center itself has become arrogant and has focused on things that I don't think are important to the program.
Such as?
Since 2003, I've been arguing with the center about the research on trying to quantify windblown sand in terms of archaeological site preservation. I thought the hypothesis was not supportable.
What was the hypothesis?
The hypothesis was that the reason archaeological sites are eroding in the Grand Canyon is because there are no longer seasonal floods, and there's no longer the sediment in the system, because it's trapped behind the dam, that would come up and deposit more sand on the archaeological sites.
And protect them from erosion.
Protect them from erosion, right.
So the sand is going away, and there's nothing replacing it.
Right, and so they felt that, okay, so what we can do is we do our experimental flows, the floods, you put the sand on the beaches, and then the wind comes and blows the sand onto these sites, and that preserves the sites. I said, well, you know, windblown sand could leave the site. That the sand that's been contributed to the site could be gone by the next wind event, as long as the wind's coming from a different direction. Or the next precipitation event could wash the sand. There's nothing there to armor the sand to stay on the site.
Mm-hmm.
They're just spending a lot of money doing this, trying to quantify it.
Mm-hmm.
By using LIDAR and total station mapping and stuff like that. I thought, well, that seems to be a lot of money spent gazing at your navel.
Mm.
You're really not being effective. At least I didn't believe it was, and so I continued to criticize it.
Did you have some suggestions for what you thought would be more valuable research?
I told them, why don't you look at past excavations that have been done in the Grand Canyon, archaeological excavation, and look at what the stratigraphy is of archaeological sites,
uh-huh.
and determine how much is caused by floods and how much is caused by wind deposit
uh-huh.
in terms of preservation. You know,
have they done that research yet?
Well, the last time we had this conversation, it was about a year ago, a little more.
So you're still advocating?
Well, I quit because I was. It's one of these other issues that I keep pounding my head against the wall, and nothing's happening. You know, I think I bring up legitimate issues mm-hmm. regarding this. And then at a recent technical work group meeting where we were voting on the next 2-year budget and work plan,
uh-huh.
the majority of the TWIG representatives voted to kick that out,
mm-hmm.
take that program out and no longer do it. And then the center...
The program that USGS was, that you described, that
so,
not
I'm
the
sorry.
Program you were proposing.
Right. Well, so I was criticizing the continued aeolian monitoring,
uh-huh.
aeolian sand monitoring, and saying, you know, I don't think it's producing the benefits that we want,
mm-hmm.
or is it, it's going to, and for it to actually be validated in an archaeological site, you're going to have to, you're going to have to be doing this for 100, 200 years. You know, a long time
yeah.
to make sure that it's a geomorphological process that's going to preserve the site.
Mm-hmm.
This is ridiculous. You know, all you need to do is look at it and see whether or not the site's eroding and then do something about it. And to sit and try to figure out this process.
Uh-huh.
I also said, if you think putting sand on a site is going to preserve it, why don't you get shovels and wheelbarrows and just go down?
Instead of LIDAR.
Yeah, just, well, and put sand from the beaches in it and go up and dump them on the sites.
And then watch what happens.
And then watch what happens, yeah.
So, and they defunded that recently? Defunded
no,
that?
No, they actually, when the technical work group voted on whether or not to keep that in, the majority wanted to take it out. But then the center made a unilateral decision, said, thanks for the input, but we're not going to do that.
Uh-huh.
Because we think we know better than you.
Uh-huh.
Essentially what the chief of the center said.
Uh-huh.
And so much for democracy.
Uh-huh. So you'd like to, one of the changes that you've seen in the program over time is an increasing degree of power and insularity on the part of USGS in determining what gets funded.
That's right.
And what doesn't.
That's
and
right.
You'd like to see more of the funding decisions controlled by the stakeholder groups, by AMWIG and TWIG.
Yeah, well, ultimately, the stakeholder groups are just making recommendations.
Right.
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 So the actual decisions for funding, in theory, comes to the Secretary of the Interior.
Uh-huh.
So
it's all centralized decision-making anyway, with
right.
consultation.
Who has more avenues to the Secretary of the Interior?
Mm-hmm.
It's the federal agencies.
Right.
Not the stakeholders.
Mm-hmm. How would you change that, if you could?
Well, I mean, I think what I've seen over time is that the center uses a tautological, rhetorical argument about science and its authority. Mm-hmm. So it says, the program values science in making management decisions. We're the science provider, so, and we are the science providers, mm-hmm. so we tell you about the science, because the science is considered important by the program. And so we are the authority. Mm-hmm. You're not. So we know better, mm-hmm. and you're not. And I think that, from what I see, is that it's not just science, it's competition for a limited amount of money. Mm-hmm. So, and in the years from 99 or 97 to today, the center has, for the most part, slammed the door on tribes.
From 1997 to the present.
Yeah, there was...
Was the door open prior to 1997?
We thought it might have been. But with each consecutive chief of the center, that door has been shut and locked. And I think it's because the center views tribes as a source of competition for a finite pot of money.
Okay.
In terms of doing research and monitoring. At one point in 2001, 2002, the center, in terms of riparian ecosystem monitoring, invited the tribes to participate with them. Mm-hmm. But the whole design of the monitoring was done by the center. And the places selected was done by the center. The tribes were just to come along. Uh-huh. So again, there's this power dynamic where the tribe doesn't have a say. The center is controlling the design of the science and stuff. And so how can you adequately integrate tribal values or concerns or perspectives when it's completely structured in a Western science perspective? It's not going to happen. And that effort didn't pan out very well. In fact, it didn't work at all. In fact, most of the tribes, I think, felt disenfranchised from the process. Mm-hmm. There's something I was going to say, and I slipped my mind now.
Our interview with Kerry Christensen, who works with the Wallapai tribe, he mentioned that they got elders of the tribe down all along the river to sites that they were familiar with and interested in, and they helped to select which sites would be monitored and for what reasons. And he was talking about hoping that there could be greater involvement of tribal members both in the design of the science, but also in what's often called citizen science,
right.
That is non-trained professionals doing observations. And he thought that it'd be nice if there was a lot more of that. It sounds like you would agree that there's a role for tribal members to play in collecting data, in influencing research design, and participating, you know, start to finish in the scientific studies, yes or no?
Yes, I do. I think there could be. And I think it's something that we've tried to advocate for. However, it's been my experience that mostly the center is interested in training native people to be Western scientists, mm. rather than being open to a collaborative co-management or co-research mm-hmm. initiative that takes Western science perspectives and values and indigenous perspectives and integrates them together to create a more holistic, if you will, approach to research and monitoring. Mm-hmm. That's not happening. Mm-hmm. They're still way apart.
And you're saying the reason that's not happening yet is the oversized influence of the director of GCMRC in determining how studies are designed and what gets funded.
I don't think it's just the director, the chief of the center. I think it's the attitude of scientists.
Who work there.
Yeah, I think it's the attitude that there's only one way to understand that ecosystem, and that is Western science. Because Western science equals truth. And that infuriates me to no end. Because there are multiple ways of relating to the world. There are multiple ways of knowing the world. Science is just one way of trying to understand cause and effect. The Zunis have their own perspective of the ecosystem and identifying cause and effect, which we talked about a little bit earlier. Just because this society privileges Western science doesn't mean it has a unique monopoly on understanding reality. Much of what Western science has done, especially when you're talking about ecosystem science, you can't tell me about fish populations when what you're doing is sampling fish from being caught in weirs or electrofishing, and you're only grabbing a few and then trying to extrapolate what the entire population is doing underwater that you can't see. I find that to be really kind of squishy science. But the thing is that what I'm getting at is that I think you need to assist the program to be very effective and democratic, if you will, needs to treat native perceptions of the ecosystem on an equal basis. I don't advocate that it's a better way of knowing the ecosystem, but it needs to be treated as equally with Western science. And that's not happening. I think much of the scientists in GCMRC are arrogant and are of that mindset that we are after truth. And I think it's encouraged. I think it's encouraged in university settings where they teach people to be scientists, and then when they get into work, it's reinforced. And as we talked earlier too, there's a lot of benefit that Western science could take from the Zuni perspective of this sense of stewardship and this sense that the environment that you're dealing with is composed of multiple sentient beings and that your actions on that environment have consequences, long-term consequences. I think it would make scientists much more respectful of the animals they handle, how they treat them, how they deal with them, what sorts of projects they want to design.
Let's step back, bigger picture, and I'd like to ask you to reflect on whether you think the program has been overall a beneficial effort, a good use of time, expertise, and funding over the years.
Yes. It has been.
Because
at least it
despite
has,
its flaws.
Despite its flaws, but yes, it has. I think it has overall been a positive program, positive effect, because it has various stakeholders, a wide range of stakeholders, coming to a common table and discussing the issues, in spite of the problems at that table. I think it's better. It's always positive when people are together talking about it.
And the alternative to this that you think would not be as beneficial is what you were criticizing earlier, too few people making too insular decisions. Is that
or the alternative to the adaptive management program would be lawsuits.
Ah.
most of the time you cannot get a federal agency's attention unless they're in court. And I believe from over 25 years of working in consultation with federal agencies on behalf of tribes that if they don't think the tribe has the wherewithal or the potential to sue them, they ignore them.
So this adaptive management program is valuable as an example of collaborative democratic decision making. Even though you see lots of ways that it could be improved, it should be, you think it should be sustained primarily for that reason, that it brings people of diverse perspectives to the table, forces them to listen to each other, attempts to get to a set of resource management decisions that are based on a broader set of values.
Right. Overall. I might, if I were king for a day, redesign the science center.
Draw that up if you can. What would that look like?
I might put it under reclamation directly or under the National Park Service.
Because?
Because I think that those agencies would be more responsive and accountable, if you will.
To the stakeholders?
To the stakeholders, but to the tribes.
Okay.
Than the USGS is.
Can you suggest why BOR or Park Service would be more responsive to tribes than USGS?
Because they have a history of consultation with tribes.
Okay.
And working with tribes. USGS, I don't see that it does. In fact, the USGS sees themselves as not a land manager.
Right.
Not an action agency, but a science provider.
They don't have their own land base that they're responsible for managing.
Right.
They're just a science providing agency.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
And I think that makes them callous to understanding tribal consultation and tribal values.
Interesting.
I know they have tribal programs, but again, that is to turn tribal members into Western scientists. It's not to. So, I mean, it's another form, right?
Yeah.
It's another subtle form of assimilation.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of people that don't think the Western scientific perspective is part of a culture. They think it's separate and independent from culture.
And that's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's hard to
because
change that.
I know, it's when they say, well, I'm objective. No, you're not. All the data that you look at, you're looking at through your own cultural lens.
Right.
You can't do anything but that. And so, I mean, you need to be more reflexive on how you do that. You have to take into account that you have bias. And how is the bias that you have affecting your conclusions, your end result? It needs to be sort of like a feedback loop.
Yeah, there's a couple decade long tradition of scholarship in the history of science and technology that examines the ways in which science and technology are cultural constructions. And it took a long time for those scholars like Sheila Yazanoff at Harvard. Took a long time for those scholars to make inroads in the scientific community itself to help them understand the ways in which they do their work and see the world are not, you know, objective, unfiltered truth, but are, you know, a sort of a construction of a particular culture and time and place.
Right. And I've become very sensitive to that in terms of archaeology. Most archaeologists are white, and they approach it from a Western science perspective. And so they're looking and interpreting the artifacts, features, from their cultural bias. And so when you take Zunis out to sites that have been excavated, and archaeologists pick up the most common artifacts, right? Ceramics, ground stone, and lithics or flake stone. And the Zunis look through the back dirt piles and find mineral concretions and stuff like that. Why do they throw these out? These are important. And so there's and then we interpret the archaeological record. We write narratives about prehistory that is completely divorced from the descendants. It's their heritage, but we don't talk about them.
You're talking about Western archaeologists do that.
Yeah, right.
So, narrowing down again to something more specific, can you just give us the names of some of the more important documents that have been produced that you think should be highlighted in an administrative history, and some of the more important people who have been involved, in your opinion, that have shaped the program in significant ways? Make sure that they get highlighted in administrative history.
I'm not sure who I would documents. I mean, there's been a lot of documents that are produced by the center, or in produced by the Twig or the Amwig, or in combination of the Twig and Amwig with the center and stuff. And there's supposed to be documents that guide the program, but they're then ignored, and they don't. Desired future conditions is one that have been.
You're the second person to mention
those. Been ignored, and it's now it's just sort of. There was sort of like developing this plan, and I'm not sure what's happened to that. This might be a little bit off track, but I want to bring it in. Is that in 1999, the GCMRC. Contracted for a peer evaluation panel to do the cultural resource program of the center and also the compliance program under the programmatic agreement of reclamation.
It's an external peer review panel.
An external peer review panel, yeah. And the peer review panel made recommendations. One of the recommendations that the peer review panel made was that the program needs a Native American consultation plan. Right? So that was in 2000.
Like a strategic plan for how to consult with
how
the tribes.
How and when, and you know, how that would work out. So they felt that the engagement of the tribes was not very effective, and the consultation was not mapped out, if you will, for the entire program, because you had Reclamation doing consultation, you had Park Service doing consultation, you had GCMRC doing consultation, or not. And so they asked for that. The Reclamation contracted the drafting of a consultation plan to the Wallapai tribe, and the Wallapai contracted Dean Swagey back east, who's
How do you spell his last name?
S-U-A-G-E-E, I think.
Okay.
And he's a lawyer who has dealt with the Wallapai, but dealt with tribal issues for years and years. Highly respected lawyer in terms of tribal issues. The Wallapai has drafted a 44-page document that outlined it and
submitted it.
It was real comprehensive, yeah, to the other tribes and to the other federal agencies for comment. So that was let's say that was in 2002, 2003.
Quite a while ago.
14 iterations later and same amount of years. When the document got to the federal government, to the federal agencies had a problem. They weren't willing to commit to anything. All right, so it went back and forth, back and forth. And what was actually finalized as the consultation document back in 2016, I believe, was less than 6 pages. And it was essentially a policy statement because the federal government didn't want to commit itself to anything to the tribes. And I remember at one meeting, the solicitor said, well, we also want to put in this consultation thing that nothing in this consultation plan hereby gives the rights to the gives the tribes the right to sue the federal government. I said, wait a minute. The federal government, the entity that caused genocide, displacement, forced assimilation, structured racism, doesn't trust the tribes? Are you kidding me? And I was appalled that the federal government wanted that in there.
Let me ask for clarification. Did this document want to be insulated from lawsuits over the consultation itself, or was it much more broader insulation that was written into that?
It was a very general statement, so it wasn't sure what it was focused on.
Okay.
Just that.
So it was unclear what they would be in, what kind of litigation would be insulated from.
And it hadn't actually been put in the document. The solicitors were asking to do that.
Oh, okay.
But the document then became just sort of like it's more of a philosophy about consultation rather than an actual consultation plan.
Was it ever formally adopted?
Yeah,
or is it just in draft form?
No, I think it was formally adopted.
Well, that it would be interesting to go back and ask questions of the different federal agencies that looked at and commented on that draft plan to see how it evolved over time. That would be an interesting story, I'm sure.
It would, and that information was not shared with the tribes.
Mm-hmm.
What the internal dialogue was among the five interior agencies.
So your judgment is this 2016 consultation plan that was eventually adopted doesn't have any teeth in it. It was a worthy effort. It started out better than it ended up, and you still think, like, what could be improved in the consultation plan?
Well, so what that sense tells me is that the federal government's interested in having the tribes at the table, but only for so far.
Mm-hmm.
They're only willing to listen to tribes in terms of co-management, co-decision-making, only to a point.
Mm-hmm.
They're not willing to commit themselves to anything to the tribes.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it tells me. It tells me that they're still intending on keeping the tribes to some level disenfranchised from the process. That's what I read.
So there's a direction for improvement in the program in the coming years. Less of that hierarchical power differential that you were talking about earlier, and more shared authority and shared decision making at an equal level.
That's what I'd like to see, or at least I mean, knowing full well that the way it's structured, the final decision making is done by the Secretary of Interior or Reclamation at some point. So that, because it's a legal decision, and ultimately you can't sue the entire adaptive management program, you sue an agency, that final authority rests with an individual agency or an individual. But I think it would be helpful if the decision-making process up towards the top was more transparent on how tribal concerns were considered and put into the equation. Most of the time, dealing with federal agencies, and even with this program, the tribal concerns go into a black box.
Mm.
And what comes out of that black box sometimes doesn't even look like anything the tribe asked for,
mm-hmm.
or their concerns were expressed.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't look like anything that you even looked at.
So who would you say have been some of the most important participants in the program in your time, and who do you think we should be sure to interview if they're not already on our interview list?
I think Larry Stevens. It sounds like you've already talked to him.
Yeah. He was our first interview.
Yeah, he's a wealth of information.
Yeah. And he's largely responsible for this administrative history
that's
being
right,
done. He
right.
pushed for it for 8 years.
Right. Dennis Kubley?
Yes, he is on the list, but we have not interviewed him yet. And if he, tell us a little bit about who he is and why you think he's been an important player.
Dennis first started out with Arizona Game and Fish Department and did some research, I think, on fish in the Grand Canyon. I think he may have been a technical representative to the, been a Arizona Game and Fish representative to the technical work group, but I don't quite remember. But then he was hired by Reclamation and,
to do research along the river?
No, to actually, I think he became the, for a while, the chief of the Adaptive Management Program.
Huh.
And so he was representing Reclamation when I was tweet chair. And the thing I like about Dennis is that he is very knowledgeable and very patient in taking time to explain things to the stakeholders.
Those are good qualities for an adaptive, collaborative process.
Yeah, and...
All right. Anybody else that you think was had a particular valuable impact on the program? Or is particularly knowledgeable about something?
You have Mike Berry. Michael Berry. He was the regional archaeologist.
B-E-R-R-Y?
Yes.
Or B-A-R?
B-E-R-R-Y, Michael Berry.
Archaeologist.
Yeah, he's in Durango, I think. He's retired now. He's a very smart archaeologist, and
when was he involved?
From, I'm guessing, 2003 till about... maybe 2010?
Mm-hmm. That's probably why he isn't yet on our list, because we're trying to get the people who have been involved from the beginning while they still have good memories of the program,
right.
And sort of, you know, record and preserve those memories and then move forward in time.
Right.
Michael Berry, archaeologist, Durango.
And so, Rick Gold, he must have... He was the regional director for Reclamation during the EIS, and then the first part of the, I think he was still there during the first part of the adaptive management. Steve Carruthers?
Yeah, Steve's been mentioned by a number of people. And
so Steve Carruthers
was on our radar.
Was more or less my mentor
uh-huh.
in this program, because Steve Carruthers was hired by the Hopi tribe, when the Hopi tribe became a cooperating agency. And so Steve and I used to go together to cooperating agency meetings, and he was able, he was, because I was completely a neophyte to this whole, to the Grand Canyon, everything like that, and the whole ecosystem management. And so he helped me understand the positions of the federal agencies,
uh-huh.
and what a lot of the biological issues were mm-hmm. and stuff. So
he had a lot of research contracts in the early years.
Yeah,
I suppose before GCMRC took over.
Oh yeah, yeah.
More of the scientific research.
Yeah, before GCMRC, there was GCES, right?
Right.
Glen Canyon Environmental Studies, mm-hmm. and that was Dave Wagner.
Mm-hmm. We interviewed him in Tucson. That was a great interview.
Who came to Hopi to get Hopi as a cooperating agency.
Uh-huh.
And so Dave Wagner's also one that was very influential and instrumental in my understanding of the program.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he had a lot of experience at the federal level with the agencies, and he was a very interesting interview. Okay, yeah, these are good names. Who else?
What's his name? I can't think of his name. The guy who worked for Arizona Game and Fish as well. Then moved to GCMRC. He was, I think, the second twig chair. I can't think of his name right offhand.
Let's pause for a second.
All right. Resuming recording.
So, Kurt, are you hopeful about the program's future, and do you think it should be continued? Because it is quite an investment of time and money for the federal government.
Well, I mean, it's paid by power revenues.
Mm-hmm.
So the federal government's not really putting any that much money into it directly. It's paid by ratepayers.
Yeah, ultimately. And of course, all the federal government money is paid by taxpayers.
True.
It all comes from us, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah. The only really appropriated money is the money that is provided by the Department of the Interior to help support tribal participation.
Uh-huh.
And that's, I think, begrudgingly given by each of the five interior agencies that are part of the program.
Uh-huh. Out of their regular budget.
I think so, uh-huh. Yeah. I don't know how that, it took many, many years to get that going.
Uh-huh.
I guess to answer your question, it depends on which day you ask me.
Uh-huh.
And whether I've just been to a frustrating twig meeting or not.
Yeah.
Now, the answer I give you today may be different from an answer I give you next Friday after I come away from the AMWIG meetings.
Right.
Or even on Wednesday morning after I've been to the pre-AMWIG tribe DOI agency meetings.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But I think I'm a hopelessly optimistic about things. In spite of my cynicism,
mm-hmm.
I do think that when people are talking across the table to each other, that is beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
So when we stop talking, then you start to get into trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, in a sense, this is a socio-political experiment, this adaptive management program. It's an attempt to do natural resource decision making differently than we were doing in decades prior. And just like a scientific study, if it's not producing results, you can have that conversation about whether the money ought to be spent, money and time ought to be spent more wisely somewhere else. So that's why I always ask this question of people who've been involved. You know, it is a struggle. There are disappointments and frustrations. It does cost money. And so I always want to know from people, do you feel that it should be continued? Is it worth the investment?
I do. But I also think that the program needs to be more reflexive.
Uh-huh.
It needs to spend time analyzing how it operates.
Uh-huh.
Analyzing how it gets to decisions. It needs to take a look at what the power structure is
uh-huh.
within there and how that power structure works to disenfranchise and silence voices.
Mm-hmm. You know, a long time ago, Mary Orton, in her interview with us, she told us about a very important river trip that members of the program took together to try to get over a hump in which there was a time in which relations were strained, there were some strong personalities, there was a lot of conflict, and they needed to resolve those things and move forward. And it took a river trip with everybody together outside of their daily lives and talking through things. And apparently everybody who was on that trip thought that it was a really remarkable experience. Were you by any chance on that trip?
I was on that trip.
Do you think we need another one of these sort of long-term, soul-searching, reflexive, look at ourselves and reimagine ourselves kind of experience? Would that be worthwhile?
That could. It depends on how long-lasting that effect is.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that while you may be emotionally influenced at that time, once you get back to the hard reality of your office and dealing with decision making in that level where there's politics going on, that sort of kumbaya feeling kind of goes away. So
yeah, well, that river trip resulted in a document that set the path for the program's evolving future. I can't remember exactly the name of it. I'll have to go back and look it up.
No, I know what you're talking about. And it came up with this sort of preamble.
Yes.
For that document.
Yeah.
But like all documents with this program, even though they are drafted, revised, finalized, and adopted, they're not followed. Yep.
They go on a shelf.
They go on a shelf, and they're not followed. Mm-hmm. And so all that work doesn't seem to pay off, especially when you get a science program that becomes bureaucratized and that it's more interested in self-preservation than it is in anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I see has happened.
Okay.
And I read an article in American Anthropologist by a woman named Laura Ogden, who did an anthropological study of the adaptive management program of the Everglades.
Mm.
And she saw the same thing happening. I mean, that's where I went, wow, yeah, that's what's happening here.
Can you send me a link to that article, or at least the author and title, after the interview?
Yeah. One second. We can find it right here.
Now that's the value of a personal library. Mention something and then pull it off the shelf.
Well, this is not that let me look up where it is here. This is something. So this is something that I co-authored, but
Confluence of Values, the Role of Science and Native Americans in the Glen Canyon Dam Adaptive Management Program. Great.
And so this is actually describes exactly a lot of what I was talking about. And then, is this the references?
There's the Ogden article you mentioned right there. Okay. We'll make a copy of this or get a PDF.
I can send you a PDF of that article.
That would be perfect. Really.
So if I get your I got your email address, so I can send it to you.
All right, great.
Yeah.
Last question. Let's say you decide to retire in the coming years and somebody else is going to take over as representative of either the Hopi or the Zuni tribe. You've worked for both. What advice would you give the next person coming in to do the kind of job that you're doing now? What advice would you give them?
It takes a long time to understand the issues. mean, I've been doing this now for over 20 years, and it took a long time to try to understand and follow the issues. And so it takes a lot of work to get up to the right speed to just even participate in the program, because there's been so much that has gone on, mm-hmm. and the resource issues are very complex.
So read up a lot, be patient,
well, it's
become knowledgeable.
And it's good to have someone who can act as your mentor to help explain things, not just the science, what's going on there, but to also explain the political dynamics that are going on with individuals. Because more than agencies, it's the individual that represents the agency that you're dealing with that is really influential. Whether they're open to other opinions, whether they're open to considering different views and different aspects, or whether they're really entrenched in for their agency and aren't willing to waver either way.
Mm-hmm. How did you find a mentor?
Well, right, Steve Carruthers was hired by Hopi.
So, and you were working for Hopi at the time.
Right.
And
so Steve and I went to meetings together.
Uh-huh. So find somebody who has similar interests, who has more experience, who you can...
Well, I mean, if you are taking over for someone who's representing a tribe or an organization in the Adaptive Management Program, then your agency or organization needs to put you with that person for at least a good year to attend these meetings and stuff, so that they can explain to you what's going on. You can start to see the situation and hear it and listen to it and start to feel comfortable with it. If you just get thrown in it, you're going to be lost.
Uh-huh.
And it's going to be real intimidating. And the other thing is, don't be shy. Because it's, you know, you have to be willing to put some skin in the game and be willing to put your neck out, and it's going to get chopped, and you're going to take some bruises, but it's all a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't take it personally.
Good advice. Anything else you'd like to add, or any closing thoughts?
No, you'll be gone, and I'll think of all sorts of things.
Sure.
I told you.
Yeah, send them via email. Yeah, Jen and I are going to work on writing an administrative history over the next 6 months or so, and we're happy to have any additional ideas or advice as they come to you.
Great. Hope this has been beneficial for you.
Yes. Yeah, really appreciate you giving us your time today, Kurt.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.